Chapter 29. Something Flickers.
"This do be madness,"
Doman rumbled from where he stood with his arms folded as if blocking the way out of the wagon. Maybe he was. His jaw was thrust forward belligerently, sticking out a beard that was trimmed short, but still longer than the hair on his head, and he was working his hands like a man thinking of making fists, or grappling with something. A wide man, Doman, and not as fat as he looked on first glance. Matt wanted to avoid fists or grappling, if he could. He finished tying the black silk scarf around his neck, hiding his scar, and tucked the long ends into his coat. The chance that there was anyone in Jurador who knew about a man in Ebu Dar wearing a black scarf, well, the odds seemed good, even discounting his luck. Of course, there was always his being Tavirin to be factored in, but if that was going to bring him face to face with Suroth or a fistful of servants from the Terrasen Palace, he could stay in bed with a blanket wrapped around his head, and it still would happen. Sometimes you just had to trust to luck. The trouble was, when he woke this morning, the dice had again been tumbling in his head. They were bouncing off the inside of his skull still. "I promised," he said. It was good to be back in decent clothes. The coat was a fine green wool, well cut and hanging almost to his knees in the turned-down tops of his boots. There was no embroidery, maybe it could do with a little, but he had a touch of lace at his cuffs. And a good silk shirt. He wished he had a mirror. A man needed to look his best on a day like this. Picking up his cloak from the bed, he swung it across his shoulders. Not a gaudy thing like Luca's. Dark gray, nearly as dark as night. Only the lining was red. His cloak pin was simple silver knots, no larger than his thumbs.
"She gave her word, Bale," Eginin said. "Her word. She will not break that, ever."
Eginin sounded absolutely convinced. More convinced than Matt was, anyway. But sometimes a man had to take a chance. Even if he was wagering his neck. He had promised. And he did have his luck.
"It'd still be madness," Doman grumbled.
But he moved grudgingly away from the door when Matt settled his broad-brimmed black hat on his head. Well, when Eginin motioned him aside with a quick jerk of her head, anyway. He kept his glower, though. She followed Matt out of the wagon, scowling herself and fiddling with her long black wig. Maybe she still felt uneasy with it, or maybe it fit differently now that she had close to a month's growth of her own hair underneath. Not enough to go about bareheaded yet, in any case. Not till there was at least another 100 miles between them and Ebu Dar. Maybe it would not be safe until they crossed the Damona Mountains into Murindi. The sky was clear, the sun just cresting the horizon, invisible yet behind the show's canvas wall, and the morning was warm only compared to a snowstorm. Not the crispness of a late winter morning in the Two Rivers, but a chill that slowly bored deep and put a faint mist in your breath. The show folk were scurrying about like ants in a kicked anthill, filling the air with shouted demands to know who had moved those juggling rings or borrowed that pair of red-spangled breeches or shifted this performing platform. It looked and sounded like the start of a riot, yet there was no real anger in any of the voices. They shouted and waved arms all the time, but it never came to blows when there was a show in the offing, and somehow every performer would be in place and ready before the first patrons were let in. They might be slow packing up for the road, but performing meant money, and they could move fast enough for that.
"You really do think you can marry her," Eginin muttered,
striding along at his side, kicking her worn brown woolen skirts. There was nothing dainty about Eginin. She had a long stride, and she kept up easily. Dress or no dress, she seemed to need a sword on her hip.
"There's no other explanation for this. Bale is right. You are mad."
Matt grinned. "The question is, does she mean to marry me?
The strangest people marry sometimes."
When you knew you were going to hang, the only thing to do was grin at the noose. So he grinned and left her standing there with a scowl on her hard face. He thought she was growling curses under her breath, though he did not understand why. She was not the one who had to marry the last person on earth she wanted to. A noble woman, all cool reserve and her nose in the air, when he liked barmaids with ready smiles and willing eyes. The heir to a throne, and not just any throne, the crystal throne, the imperial throne of Shonchan. A woman who spun his head like a top and left him wondering whether he held her captive or she held him. When fate gripped you by the throat, there was nothing to do but grin. He kept a jaunty pace till he was inside of the windowless purple wagon, and then he missed a step.
A cluster of acrobats, four limber men who called themselves the Chabana brothers, though it was plain as their noses they came from different countries, not just different mothers, rushed out of a green wagon nearby, shouting and gesturing wildly at one another. They spared a glance for the purple wagon and another for Matt, but they were too engrossed in their argument, and trotting too fast for more. Gorderon was leaning against one of the purple wheels, scratching his head and frowning at the two women who stood at the foot of the wagon's wooden steps. Two women, both swathed in dark cloaks, faces concealed, yet there was no mistaking the flowered headscarf hanging out of the taller woman's cowl. Well, he should have known Tuon would want her maid along. Noble women never went anywhere without a maid. Bet a penny or bet a crown, in the end it all came down to a toss of the dice just the same. They had had their chance to betray him. Still, he was betting on a woman making the same choice twice running. On two women doing it. What fool would make odds on that? But he had to toss the dice. Except they were already rolling. He met Seleucia's cold blue stare with a smile and swept off his hat to make an elegant leg to Tuon. Not too showy, with just a small flourish of his cloak. Are you ready to go shopping? He very nearly called her Milady, but until she was willing to say his name.
I have been ready for an hour, Toy,
Tuon drawled coolly. Casually lifting an edge of his cloak, she glanced at the red silk lining and eyed his coat before letting the cloak fall.
Lace suits you. Perhaps I will have lace added to your robes if I make you a cupbearer.
His smile slipped for an instant. Could she still make him Dako Vale if she married him? He would have to ask Aginan. Light, why did women never make it easy?
Do you want me to come along, my lord? Gorderon asked slowly, not quite looking at the women now.
He tucked his thumbs behind his belt and did not quite look at Matt either.
Just carry, maybe?
Tuon did not say a word. She just stood there looking up at Matt, waiting, big eyes getting cooler by the second. The dice bounced and rattled in his head. Well, he only hesitated a heartbeat before jerking his head to send the red arm away. Maybe two heartbeats. He had to trust his luck, trust her word. Trust is the sound of death. He stepped on that thought hard. This was no song, and no old memory could guide him. The dice inside his skull kept spinning. With a slight bow, he offered his arm, which Tuon examined as if she had never seen an arm before, pursing those full lips. Then she gathered her cloak and set off with Seleucia gliding at her heels, leaving him to hurry after them. No, women never did make it easy. Despite the early hour, two burly fellows with cudgels were already guarding the entrance, and a third, with a clear glass pitcher to take the coins and dump them through a slot in the iron-strapped box on the ground. Each of the three looked too clumsy to palm a copper without falling on his face. But Luca took no chances. 20 or 30 people were already waiting inside the heavy ropes that led to the big blue banner naming Luca's show, and unfortunately, Littell was there too, stern-faced in a dress sewn with crimson spangles and a cloak sewn with blue. Luca's wife trained bears. Matt thought the bears did their tricks for fear she might bite them. I have everything in hand, he told her. Believe me, there's nothing to worry about. He might as well have spared his breath. Littell ignored him, frowning worriedly at Tuon and Seleucia. She and her husband were the only two show folk who knew who they were. There had seemed no reason to tell either about this morning's jaunt. Luca, at least, would have had kittens. The stare Littell shifted to Matt was not worried, just stone hard.
Remember, she said quietly, if you send us to the gallows, you send yourself.
Then she sniffed and went back to studying the people waiting to get in. Littell was even better than Luca at judging the weight of a purse before the drawstrings were undone. She was also 10 times tougher than her husband. The dice tumbled on. Whatever had set them spinning, he had not yet reached the fateful point, the deciding point.
She is a good wife for Master Luca,
Tuon murmured when they had gone a little way. Matt looked at her sideways and resettled his hat on his head. There had been no mockery in her tone. Did she hate Luca that much? Or was she saying what sort of wife she would be? Or, burn him, he could go as crazy as Doman thought he was, trying to puzzle this woman out. She had to be the reason for the feel of the dice in his head. What was she going to do? It was a short walk away from the rising sun to the town, along a hard-packed road through hills that were treeless here. But people dotted the road the way windmills and salt pans dotted the hills.
Staring straight ahead, they moved so purposefully they seemed not to see anyone in front of them. Matt dodged a round-faced man and nearly walked right into him, which made him have to jump away from a white-haired old fellow, making a good speed on spindly legs. That put him in front of a plump girl, who would have run up the front of him if he had not jumped again.
"Are you practicing a dance, Toy?" Tuan said, peering up at him over a slim shoulder.
Her breath made a faint white mist in front of her cowl.
"It isn't very graceful."
He opened his mouth just to point out how crowded the road was, and suddenly he realized he could no longer see anyone beyond her and Seleucia. The people who had been there were just gone, the road empty as far as he could see before it made a bend. Slowly he turned his head. There was no one between him and the show either, just the folk waiting in line, and that looked no longer than before. Beyond the show, the road wound into the hills toward a distant forest, empty. Not a soul in sight. He pressed fingers against his chest, feeling the fox-head medallion through his coat. Just a piece of silver on a rawhide cord. He wished it felt cold as ice. Tuan arched an eyebrow. Seleucia's stare named him fool.
"I can't buy you a dress standing here," he said.
That was the point of this expedition, his promise to find Tuan something better than dresses that hung on her and made her look like a child in grown-up's clothing. At least he was pretty sure he had promised that, and she was perfectly certain. The needlework of the show's seamstresses met with Tuan's approval, but not the cloth they had available. Performers' costumes glittered with spangles and beads and bright colors, but the cloth was usually whatever could be found cheaply. Those who had better kept it and used it till it wore out. Jurador made its money from salt, though, and salt made a great deal of money. The town's shops should offer any sort of material a woman could wish. There was no finger-wiggling this time. Tuan shared a look with Seleucia. The taller woman shook her head, a wry, rueful twist to her mouth. Tuan shook her head. And they gathered their cloaks and started toward the town's iron-studded gates. Women. He hurried to catch up again. They were his prisoners, after all. They were. Their shadows stretched out long in front of them. Had any of those people cast shadows before they vanished? He could not recall any of them breathing a mist, either. It hardly seemed to matter. They were gone, and he was not going to think about where they had come from or where they had gone. Probably something to do with being Taviran. He was going to put it out of his head. He was. The dice rattling away left room for nothing else. The gate guards seemed incurious about strangers, or at least about a man and two women afoot. Hard-faced fellows in white-painted breastplates and conical helmets with what looked like horsetails for crests, they ran impassive eyes over the cloaked women, lingering suspiciously a moment on Matt for some reason, and then returned to leaning on their halberds and staring blankly at the road. They were local men, most likely, in any case, not Seanchan. The salt merchants and the local lady, Ithalin, who apparently said whatever the salt merchants told her to, had sworn the oaths of return without hesitation and offered to pay a salt tax before they were asked. No doubt the Seanchan would get around to installing some sort of official here eventually, just to keep an eye on everything, but for the moment, they had more important uses for their soldiers. Matt had sent Tom and Julin both to make sure there were no Seanchan in Jurador before agreeing to this excursion. A fool could trip over his own luck if he was not careful. It was a prosperous, busy town, Jurador, with stone-paved streets, most of them wide and all lined with stone buildings roofed in reddish tiles. Houses and inns rubbed shoulders with stables and taverns, in a noisy jumble with a blacksmith's clanging hammer on an anvil here, and the racketing of a rug-weaver's looms there, and everywhere, it seemed, coopers hammering bands on tight barrels for transporting salt. Hawkers cried pins and ribbons, meat pies and roasted nuts from trays, or winter-wrinkled turnips and sorry plums from barrows. On every street, men and women stood guard over the display goods on narrow tables in front of their shops, and bellowed lists of what was offered within. Picking out the salt merchants' houses was easy, though. 3 stories of stone rather than 2, covering 8 times as much ground as any others, each with a columned walk overlooking the street and shielded by white, wrought-iron screens between the columns. The lower windows on most houses had those screens, though not always painted. That much was reminiscent of Ebu Dar, but little else was, beyond the olive complexions of the people. There were no deep necklines exposing cleavage here, no skirts sewn up to display colored petticoats. The women wore embroidered dresses with high necks right up to their chins, a little embroidery for the common folk, a great deal for the richer, who wore cloaks embroidered top to bottom and sheer veils hanging over their faces from combs of goldwork or carved ivory stuck into dark, coiled braids. The men's short coats were worked almost as thickly in colors just as bright, and rich or poor, most men wore a long belt knife with a blade a little less curved than those in Ebudar. Rich or poor, the fellows did have a tendency to fondle their knife hilts as if expecting a fight, so maybe that was the same. The Lady Ethelan's palace appeared no different from the outside than the salt merchant's mansions, but it was located in the town's main square, a wide expanse of polished stone where a broad round marble fountain sprayed water into the air. People filled their buckets and big pottery water jars from pipes spilling into stone basins at the corners of other squares, though. The big fountain put out a smell of brine. It was a symbol of Jurador's wealth, pumped from the same source as the salt wells in the surrounding hills. Matt got to see a good deal of the town before the sun climbed even halfway to its noon peak. Every time Tuon and Seleucia spotted a shop with silks displayed out front, they stopped at the long narrow table to feel bolts of cloth and whisper with their heads together, waving off the attentions of the watchful shopkeeper. Those kept a very watchful eye until they realized Matt was with the two women. In their stout woolens, well worn and badly fitting, they did not look like customers for silk. Matt, with one side of his cloak thrown back to expose the lining, did. Whenever he tried to show an interest, though, women said they wanted you to show an interest. Whenever he got close enough to hear what they were saying, the women fell silent and looked at him, cool dark eyes and cool blue staring out of their deep cowls, until he fell back a step or two. Then Seleucia would bend her head to Tuon's, and they would go back to murmuring and fingering silk, red silk, blue silk, green silk, smooth shimmering silk, and brocaded silk. Jurador was a very wealthy town. Luckily, he had tucked a fat purse of gold into his coat pocket. None of it seemed to be right, though. Inevitably, Tuon shook her head, and the pair of them glided away into the crowd, with Matt hurrying to keep up as far as the next shop, showing silks. The dice continued to bounce off the inside of his skull. They were not the only ones from the show who had come into the town. He spotted Aludra, her face framed by beaded braids, walking through the crowd with a gray-haired man who had to be a salt merchant from the amount of bright embroidery covering his silk coat and flowers and hummingbirds. What would the Illuminator want with a salt merchant? Whatever she was saying to him, his pleased smile had added a few creases to his face, and he was nodding. Tuon shook her head, and the two women glided toward the next shop, ignoring the shopkeeper's deep bows. Well, most of those were directed at Matt. Maybe the skinny fool thought he wanted to buy silk for himself. Not that he would have passed up a new silk coat or three, but who could think about coats when he was waiting for those bloody dice to stop? Just a little embroidery, on the sleeves and shoulders. Tom went by, clutching his bronze-colored cloak around him, knuckling his long white mustaches, and yawning as if he had spent the night awake. He might have. The Gleeman had not taken to drink again, but Lopin and Nerim complained about him remaining awake till all hours, burning a lamp so he could read and reread his precious letter. What could be so fascinating in a letter from a dead woman? A dead woman. Light, maybe those people on the road... No, he was not going to think about that at all. Tuon plucked one fold of silk and let it drop as she turned away without trying another. Seleucia gave the stout shopkeeper such a stare before following that the woman started back in affront. Matt offered her a smile. Affronted shopkeepers could lead to town guards asking questions, and who could say where that might lead? He knew he could smile most women into feeling soothed. The round-faced woman sniffed at him and bent to smoothing the bolt of silk as tenderly as tucking in a babe. Most women, he thought sourly. Down the street, a woman in a plain cloak let her hood fall back, and Matt's breath caught in his throat. Edesina lifted her cowl again, but she took no hurry with it. And the damage was done anyway, an Aes Sedai's ageless face displayed for anyone who knew what they were seeing. No one in the street gave a sign that they had noticed anything, but he could not see every face. Was anyone thinking of a reward? There might be no Seanchan and Jurador at the moment, but they did pass through. Edesina glided around a corner, and two dark-cloaked shapes followed her. Two. Had the Suldam left only one of their number in the camp to watch two Aes Sedai? Or maybe Jolene or Teslin was somewhere close by, and he had missed seeing her. He craned his neck, searching the throng for another plain cloak, but everyone he saw had at least a little embroidery. Abruptly, it hit him like a stone between the eyes. Every cloak he could see had at least a little embroidery. Where were bloody Tuon and bloody Seleucia? Were the dice spinning faster? Breathing hard, he went up on his toes, but the street was a river of embroidered cloaks, embroidered coats, and dresses. It did not mean they were trying to escape. Tuan had given her word. She had passed up a perfect chance for betrayal. But all either woman had to do was say three words, and anyone who heard them likely would recognize a Shanshan accent. That might be sufficient to set the hounds on his trail. There were two shops ahead that seemed to be offering cloth, one on either side of the street. Neither were the pair of dark-cloaked women at the tables out front. They could have turned a corner easily enough, but he had to trust to luck. His luck was especially good when the game was random. Bloody women probably thought it was a bloody game. Burnham let his luck run good. Closing his eyes, he spun in a circle in the middle of the street and took a step. At random. He bumped into someone solid, hard enough to make them both grunt. A bulky fellow with a small mouth and a little poorly done scrollwork on the shoulders of his rough coat stood glaring at him when he opened his eyes, glaring and fingering the hilt of his curved knife. Matt did not care. He was facing straight at one of the two shops. Pulling his hat down tight, he ran. The dice were rolling faster. Divided shelves stuffed with bolts of cloth lined the walls of the shop from floor to ceiling, and more stood stacked on long tables out in the floor. The shopkeeper was a scrawny woman, with a large mole on her chin, her assistant slim and pretty and angry-eyed. He dashed inside just in time to hear the shopkeeper say, "For the last time, if you won't tell me what you're here for, I'm going to send Nelsa for the guards." Tuan and Seleucia, faces still hidden in their hoods, were walking slowly along one wall full of cloth, stopping to touch a bolt, but neither paying the shopkeeper any heed.
"They're with me," Matt said breathlessly.
Tugging the purse from his pocket, he tossed it on the nearest clear table. The heavy clink it made landing put a wide smile on the shopkeeper's narrow face.
"Give them whatever they want," he told her.
And to Tuan, he added firmly,
"If you're going to buy anything, it's going to be here. I've had all the exercise I care for this morning."
He would have had the words back as soon as they left his mouth, if he could. Speak to a woman that way, and she flared in your face like one of Aludra's fire sticks every time. But Tuan's big eyes looked up at him from the shelter of her hood, and her full mouth curved slightly in a smile. It was a secret smile, for herself, not him. The light only knew what it meant. He hated it when women did that. At least the dice had not stopped. That had to be a good sign, right? Tuan had no need of words to make her choices, silently pointing out bolt after bolt and measuring with her small dark hands how much the shopkeeper was to cut off with her shears. The woman did the work herself, instead of delegating it to her assistant, and well she might, considering. Red silk in several shades went under those long sharp scissors, and green silk in a few shades, and more varieties of blue silk than Matt knew existed. Tuan chose out some fine linen in several thicknesses, and lengths of bright wool. She consulted Seleucia over those in muffled whispers, but mostly it was silk. He got back much less of his purse than he had expected. Once all that cloth had been folded and neatly tied, then bundled into a larger length of coarse linen, at no extra charge, thank you very much, it made a mound as fat as a peddler's pack. It did not surprise him at all to learn that he was expected to carry the thing across his shoulders with his hat dangling in one hand. Dress your best, buy a woman's silk, and she still found a way to make you work. Maybe she was making him pay for speaking firmly. He earned plenty of stares from gaping fools as he made his way out of the town behind the two women. They glided along smug as cats full of cream. Even cloaked and hooded, their backs said it all. The sun was still well short of midday, but the line of people waiting to get into the show stretched down the road almost to the town. Most gaped and pointed as if he were a painted fool. One of the big horse handlers guarding the coin box gave a gap-toothed smirk and opened his mouth, but Matt returned him a level look, and the fellow decided to put his eyes back on the coins going from townsfolk to glass pitcher to box. Matt thought he had never been so relieved to be inside Luca's show. Before he and the two women had gotten three steps inside the entrance, Julin came running up, for a wonder without Thera or his red cap. The thief-catcher's face could have been carved from ancient oak. Eyeing the people flowing past them into the show, he pitched his voice low, low and urgent.
"I was coming to find you. It's Aginan. She's been hurt. Come quickly."
The man's tone said enough, but worse, Matt realized the dice in his head were drumming now. He flung the pack of cloth at the horse handlers with a hasty injunction to guard it as close as the coin box, or he would set the women on them, but he did not wait to see whether they took him seriously. Julin darted back the way he had come at a run, and Matt ran after him, along the wide main street of the show, where noisy, gawking crowds were watching the four bare-chested Giovanna brothers stand on one another's shoulders, and contortionists in filmy trousers and glittering vests sit on their own heads, and a slack-rope walker in spangled blue breeches climbing a long wooden ladder to begin her performance. Short of the slack-rope walker, Julin dodged into one of the narrower streets, where laundry hung from lines between the tents and wagons, performers sat on stools and wagon steps waiting to go on, and show children ran playing with balls and hoops. Matt knew where they were headed now, but the thief-catcher ran too fast to overtake. Ahead he saw his green wagon. Littell was peering underneath, and Luca, in one of his bright red cloaks, was waving a pair of jugglers to move along. The two women, in baggy trousers and with faces painted white, like a noble's fools, took a good look under the wagon before they obeyed. As he came closer, he could see what they had been staring at. Coatless, Doman was sitting on the ground under the edge of the wagon, cradling a limp Aginan in his arms. Her eyes were closed, and a trickle of blood ran from the corner of her mouth. Her wig hung askew. That stood out for some reason. She always fussed so to keep that wig straight. The dice beat like thunder.
"This could be disaster,"
Luca growled, splitting his glower between Matt and Julin. It was an angry glower, though, not frightened.
"You may have brought me to disaster."
He shooed away a gaggle of wide-eyed children and growled at a plump woman in skirts that glittered with silvery spangles. Miora made leopards do tricks that even Latella would not try, but she merely tossed her head before gliding off. No one took Luca as seriously as he took himself. The man gave a start when Tuan and Salusha hurried up and looked on the point of telling them to go too, before he thought better of it. In fact, he began to frown thoughtfully and worriedly. It seemed his wife had not told him about Matt and the women leaving the show, and it was clear they had been somewhere. The blue-eyed woman had the huge bundle of cloth on her back now, with her arms doubled behind her, though she stood straight despite the bulk. You would think a lady's maid was used to carrying things, but her face was a picture of frustrated irritation. Littell eyed her up and down, then sneered at Matt as if he were the reason the woman was thrusting her considerable bosom out. Luca's wife was very good at sneering, yet Tuan's stern expression made Littell nearly look mild. A judge peered out of her cowl, a judge ready to pass sentence. For the moment, Matt did not care what the women thought. Those bloody dice! Tossing his cloak back, he went to one knee and touched fingers to Aginan's throat. Her pulse beat weakly, thin and fluttering. "What happened?" he asked. "Have you sent for one of the sisters?" Moving Aginan might be enough to kill her, but there might be time for healing if the Aes Sedai were quick. He was not about to say that name aloud, though, with people walking by, pausing for curious stares before Luca or Littell hurried them on. Everyone moved quicker for her than for him. Littell herself was the only one who really jumped for Luca.
"Renna,"
Doman spat the name. Despite his short cap of hair, that Ilioner beard that left his upper lip bare, he did not look ridiculous now. He looked afraid and murderous, a dangerous combination.
"I did see her stab Aginan in the back and run. If I could have reached her, I would have broken her neck, but my hand be all that's holding Aginan's blood in. Where be that bloody Aes Sedai?"
he snarled. So much for being careful with his tongue.
"I be right here, Bale Doman," Teslin announced coldly, rushing up with Thera, who took one horrified look at Tuan and Salusha and latched onto Julin's arm with a squeak, eyes on the ground. The way she began trembling, she might be there herself in a minute.
The hard-eyed Aes Sedai made her face as if she had a mouthful of briars when she saw what lay in front of her, or maybe where it lay, but she swiftly crouched underneath the wagon beside Doman and clasped Aginan's head in her bony hands.
"Jolene do be better at this than I," she muttered, half under her breath. "But I may be able—"
The silver fox head went cold against Matt's chest, and Aginan jerked so violently that her wig fell off, nearly pulling herself out of Doman's grasp as her eyes popped open wide. The convulsion lasted only long enough for her to sit halfway up with a frozen gasp. Then she slumped back against Doman's chest, panting, and the medallion became just a piece of worked silver again. He was almost accustomed to that. He hated being accustomed to that. Teslin slumped too, on the point of falling over until Doman shifted his grip on Aginan to steady the Aes Sedai with one hand.
"Thank you,"
Teslin said after a moment, the words sounding dragged from her.
"But I need no help."
She used the side of the wagon to help her rise, though, her cold Aes Sedai gaze daring anyone to comment.
"The blade did slide on a rib, and so did miss her heart. All she does need now be rest and food."
She had not delayed to grab a cloak, Matt realized. In one direction, along the narrow street, a clutch of women in spangled cloaks was watching from in front of a green-striped tent, their gazes intent and focused. In the other, half a dozen men and women in white-striped coats and tight breeches, acrobats who performed on horseback, darted looks toward Teslin between putting their heads together to whisper. Too late to worry about someone recognizing an Aes Sedai's face. Too late to worry that one of them knew healing when he saw it done. The dice battered at the inside of Matt's head. They had not stopped. The game was not played out yet. "Who's looking for her, Julin?" he asked. "Julin!" The thief-catcher gave over glaring at Tuon and Seleucia and murmuring to Thera, though he continued to pat the trembling woman.
"Vannon and the Red Arms, Lopin and Nerim. Oliver, too. He was away before I could catch him. But in this..."
He stopped soothing Thera long enough to gesture toward the main street. The babble of voices was clearly audible, even at this distance.
"All she needs is to lay hands on one of those fancy cloaks and she can slip out with the first folk to leave. If we try stopping every woman with her hood up, or even try looking inside, we'll have a riot on our hands. These people are touchy."
"Disaster,"
Luca moaned, wrapping his cloak around himself tightly. Littell put an arm around him. It must have been like being comforted by a leopard, but in any case, Luca did not look much comforted.
"Burn me, why?" Matt growled. "Renna was always ready to lick my bloody wrist. I thought if anybody went over the edge..."
He did not even glance at Thera, but Julin still scowled at him darkly. Domin had stood up with Aginin in his arms. She struggled feebly at first. Aginin was not a woman to let herself be carried about like a doll, but eventually she seemed to realize that if she did make her own feet, she would fall over. She sagged against the Ilioner's chest with a resentful glower. Domin would learn, even when a woman needed help, if she did not want it, she made you pay for giving it.
"I'm the only one who knew her secret," she drawled in a weak voice. "The only one who might give it away, at least. She may have thought it would be safe to go home with me dead."
"What secret?" Matt asked.
The woman hesitated for some reason, frowning at Doman's chest. Finally, she sighed.
"Renna was leashed once. So were Bethamon and Sita. They can channel. Or maybe learn to. I don't know. But the Eidam worked on those three. Maybe it works on any Suldam."
Matt whistled through his teeth. Now that would be a kick in the head for the Seanchan. Luca and his wife exchanged puzzled glances, plainly not understanding a word. Teslin's mouth hung open, Aes Sedai's serenity washed away in shock. Seleucia made an angry sound, though, blue eyes blazing, and dropped the bundle of cloth from her back as she took a step toward Domin. A quick flash of Tuon's fingers stopped her in her tracks, though it was a quivering halt. Tuon's face was a dark mask, unreadable. She did not like what she had heard, though. Come to think, she had said she trained Damani. Oh, burn him. On top of everything else, he was going to marry a woman who could channel? The sound of horses' hooves announced Harnan and the other three Red Arms, coming along the narrow way between the tents and wagons at a quick trot. Their swords were belted on under their cloaks, Metwin with a dagger almost as long as a short sword to boot, and Gorderon had his heavy crossbow hanging at his saddle, already drawn and latched. The crank at his belt would take a full minute to pull back the thick cord, but this way, all he need do was place a bolt. Harnan carried a double-curve horsebow with a bristling quiver at his hip. Fergan was leading Pips. Harnan did not bother dismounting. Eyeing Tuon and Seleucia suspiciously, and Luca and Littell with almost as much doubt, he leaned down from his saddle, the crude hawk tattoo sharp on his cheek.
"Renna stole a horse, my lord," he said quietly. "Rode down one of the horse handlers at the entrance getting out. Vannon's following her. He says she could reach Coromin sometime tonight. That's the way she's headed. She's moving a lot faster than the wagons did. But she's riding bareback. We can catch her with luck."
He sounded as if that luck were a matter of fact. The men of the band trusted Matt Cawthon's luck more than he did himself. There did not seem to be any choices, really. The dice were still pounding in his head. There was still a chance they might fall his way. A small chance. Matt Cawthon's luck.
"Get your people on the road as fast as they can pack up, Luca," he said, stepping up onto Pips. "Leave the wall and anything else you can't get onto the wagons fast. Just go."
"Are you crazy?"
Luca spluttered. "If I try to chase those people out, I will have a riot. And they'll want their coin back."
Like the man would think of money with his neck stretched on the headsman's block.
"Think what you'll have if 1,000 Seanchan find you here tomorrow."
Matt's voice was as cold as he could make it. If he failed, the Seanchan would run Luca's show down in short order, however fast they flogged their horses. Luca knew it too, from the twist of his mouth, as if he had just bitten a rotting plum. Matt made himself ignore the man. The dice were drumming hard, but they had not stopped yet.
Julin, leave all the gold for Luca except one good purse.
Maybe the man could bribe his way clear, once the Seanchan saw he did not have their daughter of the Nine Bloody Moons.
Gather everybody and ride out as soon as you can. Once you're out of sight of the town, take to the forest. I'll find you.
Everybody?
Sheltering Thera with his body, Julin jerked his head toward Tuan and Salusha.
Leave those two in Jurador, and the Seanchan might stop with getting them back. It might slow them down, at least. You keep saying you're going to turn them loose sooner or later.
Matt met Tuan's eyes. Big, dark, liquid eyes, and a smooth, expressionless face. She had pushed her hood back a little, so he could see her face clearly. If he left her behind, then she could not say the words, or if she did, he would be too far away for the words to matter. If he left her behind, he would never learn why she smiled those mysterious smiles, or what lay behind the mystery.
Light, he was a fool. Pips danced a few impatient steps. Everybody, he said.
Did Tuan nod slightly as if to herself? Why would she nod?
Let's ride, he told Harnan.
They had to walk their horses through the crowds to get out of the show, but as soon as they reached the road, Matt put Pips to a gallop, cloak streaming behind and head down to keep his hat from blowing off. It was not a pace you could keep a horse at for long. The road wound around hills and crossed ridges, occasionally cutting through where the rise was not too high. They splashed across ankle-deep streams and thundered over low wooden bridges crossing deeper water. Trees began to appear on the slopes again, pine and leatherleaf showing green among the winter-bare branches of the others. Farms clung to some of the hills, low tile-roofed stone houses and taller barns, and now and then a hamlet of 8 or 10 houses. A few miles from the show, Matt spotted a wide man ahead of them, sitting his saddle like a sack of suet. The horse was a leggy dun, eating ground at a steady trot. It figured that a horse thief had an eye for a good animal. Catching the sound of their hooves, Vannon looked back, but he only slowed to a walk. That was bad. When Matt slowed Pips beside the dun, Vannon spat.
Best wager we got is we find her horse run to death so I can track her afoot from there, he muttered. She's pushing harder than I figured with her bare back. If we push, we can maybe catch her by sunset. If her horse don't founder or die, that's about the time she'll make Coraman.
Matt tipped back his head to glance at the sun almost straight overhead. It was a long way to cover in less than half a day. If he turned back, it could be a good distance the other side of Jurador by sunset, in company with Tom and Julin and the others. With Tuan. With the Seanchan knowing to hunt Matt Cawthon. The man who had kidnapped the daughter of the Nine Moons could not own enough luck to get off with being made Duck of Vale. And sometime tomorrow or the next day, they would plant Luca on an impaling stake. Luca and Latell, Petra and Clarine and the rest. A thicket of impaling stakes. The dice rattled and bounced in his head.
We can make it, he said.
There was no other choice. Vannon spat. There was only one way to cover a great deal of ground quickly on a horse, if you meant to be on a live horse at the end. They walked the animals for half a mile, then trotted half a mile. The same at a canter, then a run, and it was back to a walk. The sun began to slide downward, and the dice spun. Around sparsely forested hills and over tree-topped ridges, streams that could be crossed in 3 strides, barely wetting the horse's hooves, and streams 30 paces across with flat bridges of wood or sometimes stone. The sun sank lower and lower, and the dice spun faster and faster. Almost back to the Eldar, and no sign of Rena except scuffs on the hard dirt of the road that Vannon pointed to as if they were painted signs.
Getting close now, the fat man muttered.
He did not sound happy, though. Then they rounded a hill, and there was another low bridge ahead. Beyond, the road twisted north to cross the next ridge through a saddle. The sun, sitting atop the ridge, blazed in their eyes. Coraman lay on the other side of that ridge. Pulling his hat lower for shade, Matt searched the road for a woman, for anyone, mounted or afoot, and his heart sank. Vannon cursed and pointed. A lathered bay was laboring its way up the slope on the other side of the river, a woman frantically kicking its flanks, urging it to climb. Rena had been too anxious to reach the Seanchan to stick with the road. She was maybe 200 paces from them, and she might as well have been miles. Her mount was on the point of collapsing, but she could get down and run within the sight of the garrisons before they could reach her.
All she had to do was reach the crest, another 50 feet.
My lord,
Harnan said. He had an arrow knocked, and his bow half-raised. Gorderon held the heavy crossbow to his shoulder, a thick pointed bolt in place. Matt felt something flicker and die inside him. He did not know what. Something. The dice rolled like thunder.
Shoot,
he said. He wanted to close his eyes. The crossbow snapped. The bolt made a black streak through the air. Renna slammed forward when it hit her back. She had almost managed to push herself erect against the bay's neck when Harnan's arrow took her. Slowly, she toppled from the horse, sliding down the slope, rolling, bouncing off saplings, tumbling faster and faster until she splashed into the stream. For a moment, she floated face down against the bank, and then the current caught her and pulled her away, skirts billowing up on the water. Slowly, she drifted toward the Eldar. Maybe, eventually, she would reach the sea. And that made three. It hardly seemed to matter that the dice had stopped. That made three. Never again, he thought, as Renna floated out of sight around a bend. If I die for it, never again. They did not press, riding back eastward. There was no point, and Matt felt too bone-weary. They did not stop, though, except to breathe and water the horses. No one wanted to talk. It was the small hours of the night when they reached Jurador, the town a dark mass with the gates shut tight. Clouds covered the moon. Surprisingly, the canvas walls of Lucajou were still in place just beyond the town. With a pair of bulky men wrapped in blankets, snoring unaware beneath the big banner as they guarded the entrance. Even from the road, in the dark, it was plain that wagons and tents filled the space behind the wall. At least I can tell Luca he doesn't have to run after all, Matt said wearily, turning Pips toward the banner. Maybe he'll give us a place to sleep a few hours. For all the gold he had left, Luca should give him his own wagon, but knowing the man, Matt had hopes for clean straw somewhere. Tomorrow he would set out to find Tom and the others. And Tuon. Tomorrow, when he had rested. A greater shock waited inside Luca's huge wagon. It truly was roomy inside, at least for a wagon, with a narrow table sitting in the middle, and space to walk around it. Table, cupboards, and shelves all were polished till they glowed. Tuon was sitting in a gilded chair. Luca would have a chair, and gilded, when everybody else made do with stools, with Seleucia standing at her back. A beaming Luca was watching Littell offer Tuon a plate of steaming pastries, which the dark little woman was examining as if she would actually eat something that Luca's wife had cooked. Tuon showed no surprise at all at Matt walking into the wagon.
"Is she captured or dead?"
she said, picking up a pastry with her fingers curved in that curiously graceful way.
"Dead," he said flatly. "Luca, what in the light?"
"I forbid it, Toy,"
Tuon snapped, pointing a finger at him sharply.
"I forbid you to mourn a traitor."
Her voice softened slightly, but it remained firm.
"She earned death by betraying the Empire, and she would have betrayed you as easily. She was trying to betray you. What you did was justice, and I name it so."
Her tone said that if she named a thing, then it was well and truly named. Matt squeezed his eyes shut for a moment. "Is everyone else still here too?" he demanded.
"Of course,"
Luca said, still smiling like a bull-goose fool.
"The lady, the High Lady, forgive me, High Lady,"
he bowed deeply.
"She talked to Marilyn and Sandar, and, well, you see how it was. A very persuasive woman, the lady, the High Lady. Cawthon, about my gold. You said they were to hand it over, but Marilyn said he'd slit my throat first, and Sandar threatened to crack my head, and—"
He trailed off under Matt's stare, then suddenly brightened again.
"Look what the lady gave me."
Snatching open one of the cupboards, he pulled out a folded paper that he held reverently in both hands. It was thick paper and white as snow. Expensive.
"A warrant. Not sealed, of course, but signed. Valen Luca's grand traveling show and magnificent display of marvels and wonders is now under the personal protection of the High Lady Tuon Athaim Cora Payandrag. Everyone will know who that is, of course. I could go to Shanchan. I could put on my show for the Empress. May she live forever,"
he added hastily, with another bow to Tuon. For nothing, Matt thought bleakly. He sank down on one of the beds with his elbows on his knees, earning a very pointed look from Littell. Likely only Tuon's presence kept her from clouding him. Tuon raised a peremptory hand, a black porcelain doll, but every inch a queen despite the shabby too-large dress.
"You are not to use that except at need, Master Luca. Great need."
"Of course, High Lady, of course."
Luca bobbed bows as if he might be kissing the floorboards any minute.
"All for bloody nothing." "I did make specific mention of who is not under my protection, Toy."
Tuon took a bite of pastry and delicately brushed a crumb from her lip with a finger.
"Can you guess whose name heads that list?"
She smiled. Not a malicious smile. Another of those smiles for herself. Amusement or delight in something he could not see. Suddenly he noticed something. That little cluster of silk rosebuds he had given her was pinned to her shoulder. Despite himself, Matt began to laugh. He threw his hat down on the floor and laughed. With everything, all his efforts, he did not know this woman at all. Not a bit. He laughed until his ribs hurt.